Welcome to the Inside CCW Safe Podcast with founders Stan Campbell and Mike Darter. If you're forced to fight the battle for your life, CCW Safe will fight the battle for your future.
All right, welcome back to the Inside CCW Safe Podcast. I'm Mike Darter, and I'm in Dallas.
With Stan Campbell in Dallas.
That's right. Here for some meetings next couple days.
That's right. Get to hang out a little bit with Lieutenant Colonel Alan B. West.
Yep.
So that's going to be great. Love to get a chance to meet him. And then we have a couple of special guests also with us.
Yeah, we have Steve Moses, which has been on the show quite a few times.
That's right.
We have Steve, and we also have Alan McBee. And let's do this. Let's do Steve. Give a little just bio on yourself, and then you can introduce Alan. And then we're going to talk today about modern day church security.
That's right.
All right. Good morning, guys. Again, my name is Steve Moses. I'm based out of the DFW area. That's primarily where I do most of the training. I have been a firearms and tactics instructor since 1994. I'm a reserve deputy police officer. I was on a special response team for 11 years. I am kind of a training junkie. I've probably taken over 80 law enforcement and private sector classes. I teach jiu-jitsu in East Texas, and my partner, Alan McBee, and myself, we own and operate Palisade Training Group. Alan has been with me since, 1994, is that correct? And he was actually one of the students in the very first defensive handgun course that I ever taught. So Alan and I have since then formed a partnership. We have taken multiple classes together. We've done executive protection together, and he's just been a great asset. As a matter of fact, Alan, why don't you go ahead and give me a little bit more detail, or give our audience a little more details on your background.
Well, like you said, we started teaching together in 1994, I was fairly active in the executive protection, private security space for about a dozen years in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. And we were also, not only we went down the same training path, the same kind of journey together, but worked extensively together, especially in the church security space. And whereas we were on a detail together for about 8 years at a DFW mega church. And I've got to learn quite a bit there from both the large church aspect and also the small church aspect as we went into satellite churches. So we've learned a lot together.
Awesome, awesome. You know, really for the past year, we've had a lot of members join church security volunteer teams. We have... Our Ultimate Plan actually covers that. We have a special benefit where the Ultimate Plan covers volunteer security teams as well, individually. And a lot of questions comes up about this because, you know, people want to know, they want to be part of the group, and they want to do what is right for the church and protect those that go to the church and the congregation. But many times, you know, they don't take into account, you know, the training that should go along with that. And that's one of the reasons why we brought you guys in today to talk about modern day church security, because of how important that aspect of it is. You know, just having a gun in a CCW and sitting in the middle of the church, that doesn't always cut it. Is that correct?
That is correct. Persons thinking about doing church security really need to become familiar with their own state's laws regarding use of force, their rights to arrest, detain, or even touch another person while performing church security is no greater than that of any other citizen. It's very important to realize that if you're going to do church security, your actions have the potential of making you a target for an expensive lawsuit, and perhaps even subjecting you to criminal prosecution. So this is a very serious matter. We encourage people that are very much interested in protecting the churchgoers to absolutely go down this route, as long as they understand all of the ramifications of doing so.
That's right. And I believe you wrote an article in reference to this as well. Can you kind of just, you know, break that down a little bit for us, and, you know, so that we can have just kind of a model to go off of or talking points so that the audience can keep up?
Sure. Let me cover maybe some of the key topics that were included in that article. One of the first things that we are referenced in that article is the fact that churches are particularly susceptible to the actions of violent criminals. There have been terrorist attacks in other countries that have included arson, small arms, assassinations, kidnapping, use of explosives, even chemical and biological attacks. For the most part, probably in the United States, while a terroristic attack like that is a possibility, it's probably going to be something that's more related to personal conflict and domestic spillover. You know, a lot of people that actually cause a violent action within a church have mental health, mental health disorders. And in some instances, the motivation is no more than just simply a robbery. I mean, what better place to commit a robbery than in the parking lot of a church? So we talked about that. We talked about how an incompetent response can very well subject the person doing church security to, you know, criminal prosecution. It can actually even result in an injury or a death to a innocent third party. We talked about perhaps what somebody might give some consideration to when it came to developing a church security team. And then from there, you know, we talked about certain things that church could actually do in terms of protecting staff and members, which might include, you know, designating someone as the security director, selecting and training a protective team, running background checks and interviews on church personnel, having some means of controlling exits and entrances, and perhaps even incorporating a camera system if the church is large enough and has the finances to actually get that done. You know, just stuff like that. Remember that a large percentage of crime involving churches takes place in parking lots. You know, just kind of stuff like that, Stan.
That's awesome. And then, Alan, I want to bring you in on this. Now, you were part of a team that was for or that defended a mega church, correct? Can you kind of walk us through that?
Yes, we had before the opening of the satellite churches, which again kind of introduced a whole new phase of the program. We secured a very large campus, multi-building campus, that through the course of five services, Saturday and Sunday, would have about 20,000 people through the door. And we had a nine-man, each shift was a nine-member plainclothes detail, where they were all plainclothes and armed security officers. Everyone was a licensed Texas DPS Level 4 PPO. And we also had uniformed armed security, which were known as level threes. And we also had a lot of LE support from the local PD. And so we had the benefit of a lot of technology, good camera system, good. We had a security officer in the office with a bunch of monitors. So we really had good access control and, you know, coordinated with the, you had your parkers and your greeters and your staff, and you just kind of, you know, security is based on concentric rings of protection. And you made sure everyone had good comms, and we're just on the lookouts for, you know, for things that they thought were hinky. And if something got their attention, you know, pass it up the chain and get it to the right people.
That's right. And you guys really had an awesome team. And Steve, you're part of the team as well, correct?
Yes, I was actually the chip lead. Whenever I was present, if Alan was not there, I mean, again, we're talking about five services. It was very difficult to have, you know, your team member be the same members for every service. So we had a relatively large group of officers working, but we would only assign like 8 or 9 positions at a time. When Alan was not available, I was the shift lead, which basically I was in a position that controlled the team. One of the things I would like to add is that Alan made a reference earlier to PPO, that's a personal protection officer. In Texas, at the time, in order to do armed church security, you had to be a licensed level 4 personal protection officer. In order to obtain that license, that required, at the time, a minimum of 45 hours of training that was necessary before you could actually become licensed. So all of the members of our team had at least that amount of training prior to actually being in a position where they could perform a role as a member of the church security team.
And if I could just interject, another thing we were very fortunate to have is we were a very cohesive group. We worked together. In the initial phases of the detail, we'd all worked together for a good number of a good span of time. So we all trained together. Everyone knew. Everyone was fairly comfortable with everyone else's skill set. We would have range time together as a group at least once a month, and so we were very fortunate to have a very squared away detail.
That's awesome. And, I like to bounce back and forth to make it relevant to everyone. So let's just say that I have a smaller church. It's not a mega church because the majority are not. And I want to start a volunteer security team for my church. Can one or two of you kind of, walk us through that and kind of explain how would I start one? What should I be doing? And so on and so forth.
There's actually an organization, I believe, I don't have the name of that organization. It's Chuck Chadwick's organization.
NOSCOM or something?
NOSCOM, something like that. I believe they're also, I don't want to misspeak here. That's something probably we need to look up so we can provide that information. I'm sorry, I wasn't anticipating that question. There's actually courses that can be taken on this particular subject, whereas you receive information as to how to set up a team, things the team needs to consider, specific training the team needs to undergo in order to do this properly. It's not, in my opinion, good enough to just say, hey, let's go form a church protection team. Joe, you go here. Bill, you go here and go stand out there in the parking lot. The problem with all that is you have all these people acting in an individual role with no communication. And if someone could actually find themselves in a position where they have to deal with one situation and they're unable to communicate to other people and they don't have the backup available. So there is several resources available for that. We actually teach a class on this where we actually will go to a church. We will train that team up. It's a 16-hour class that ends up with us actually setting up and running a church protective detail during an actual service. So we do that, when the demand is there. What would you add to that, Alan, you think?
It's a great class, and there's a lot that goes into it, and a lot, I feel that this change, letting people have simply be licensed to carry, lends itself. People want to be involved in something like that, but they might not only be unwilling to put in the necessary work, but they might not know which direction to head. So because there are a lot of aspects to it, obviously.
That's true, and when I think about it, from my perspective. From a former police officer, SWAT, I think about, number one, having the right personnel. you know, having the right permissions as well. So, you know, when you begin out there, or you want to be either start one or be part of one, do not do so without the knowledge and permissions in writing, most times from the pastor or the head of the church. That's number one. You need to also see if they have insurance in place to cover such a team. If they do not have anything in place, although, you know, it's a noble idea and you guys are doing the right things, you do leave yourself open for a lot of liability. So that's when, you know, similar, you know, we have, you know, our ultimate plan, but then there's also something called the Brotherhood insurance as well. There's some other packages out there that the church could pick up to also kind of layer your protection. The only difference there is any outside protection in a lot of cases is going to be that entity providing you a civil attorney, because that's usually what you're going to have to deal with. You know, in most cases, the civil liability issue is more damning than the criminal aspects of protecting a church. But they're going to be, you know, defending the interest of the insurance company and the church. So, you know, that's the difference between what we design here at CCW Safe is, you know, our civil attorneys is for the member. So that's kind of important. You have to think about your backdrop. That's why training is really, really important, because you got people running in all directions, chaos. If you have not, you know, started to train your congregation on what to do, because no matter what, and people are going to do what they do, but you have to have a plan. That's one of the reasons why at CCW Safe, we give our members a plan for what to do after an incident as well, before the incident, after the incident, knowing how to de-escalate, knowing how to, you know, to handle the suspect or the perpetrator outside of the church initially, you know, engaging out there if you can. You know, you guys talked about cameras and armed guards. I mean, all of these things are really important to consider, you know, when thinking about, you know, stepping into this arena and being the defenders of the church house. So as far as training with you guys, you said you guys train all the time and you had a kind of a cohesive unit. What would be, and without, you know, breaking down your entire class, just kind of walk through, you know, just some of the elements of how you guys developed your training.
In part, what we did was we identified scenarios that we think were likely to happen or could happen, and then how they would be addressed. We always assigned officers to specific posts. That is, they were to be in a certain position before service, during a service, between services, and after services. And so if something happened in your particular area, how would that particular officer respond to that? And what additional support from other officers could be then shuffled to that area without then leaving a key area unprotected? So it might be something that we have the minister is up on the podium. Again, this is simulation. And then all of a sudden, somebody puts a laser dot on his chest. Okay, how would we respond to that? Well, in our particular instance, there would be one officer that was actually assigned to the pastor, and his or her responsibility was then to move in there as quickly as possible, get a hold of the pastor, and move the pastor off stage while interjecting his or her body between the crowd at that time and the pastor, because all of our officers were required to wear body armor. We had officers that would be posted in different positions, ideally where they could make eye contact with the other officer, or at least see them, that would then move in. We typically had an officer that roamed, a rover, that would be basically, you know, your quick response team. And so basically, we would just set up various scenarios okay, what happens if this occurs and how can we best address it? And if I could just kind of backtrack a little bit to something that you said earlier, which is smaller churches. As Alan stated earlier, We also had three satellite churches, which did not have the same type of camera systems necessarily, and we only had one PPO or church security protective team member there present. And so basically they had a completely different environment to protect. And so basically it was a matter of where that person would then identify those areas where threats are most likely. What are your vulnerable points? We always consider the children's area a vulnerable point. And another vulnerable point was going to be the area in where the church collections were taken and you know, basically counted and bagged. And so this is just some of the scenarios that, you know, we kind of addressed. So I did want to address the fact that if you've got a competent person and that's the only person at that particular church, they can go a long ways towards securing that church and making it a safer place for everyone involved.
Hey, let's talk about one thing. Earlier, we were talking about the congregation. Let's talk a minute about that and kind of switch toward not, you know, some of these churches are huge mega churches. You got large crowds. What are some of the things that somebody in a congregation or even at a concert or, you know, some event where there's going to be a lot of people, what are some things that they can need to be thinking of if something happens at that event? We're talking about like moving with the crowd, you know, and you look at some of these, like the thing that pops in my mind is the Las Vegas shooting at the concert. You know, a lot of people are talking about what can people do in an event like that.
Well, off the top of my head, I'd say, I mean, every situation is pretty independent. You need to seek cover. You need to try, and it can be very difficult to ascertain where is the problem. You know, in an urban area, you've got echo issues and everything else. If the crowd is flowing in one certain direction, you know, it's one thing to consider is to move at a, you know, a 90 degree angle perpendicular to the flow of the crowd. Fight your way through it that way and get off to the side and try and you know, try and establish in your mind where is the threat coming from. I think a lot of these incidents can be designed to channelize people into a place they really don't want to be.
In terms of actually communicating with the congregation itself, I think it's very good that the congregation is advised that there is a protective team in place. I know that some churches try to keep that under the radar because they want everyone to feel like the church is a very friendly, inviting place. I think that's still possible by educating them. The other thing, I think, by educating the congregation, if there's a church security team in place, you're also telling them that if they decide to be the rescuer and take some heroic action, there's a very strong possibility that they may be mistaken for the attacker themselves, and they're putting themselves at risk. So we would always encourage members of the congregation to protect themselves and protect their families, that in terms of dealing with a, let's say, for instance, an active shooter or some other, you know, confrontation or conflict that's taking place in the church, leave that up to the team. The other thing that I believe is that the church should know that if an announcement is made to evacuate, then they need to evacuate in the direction indicated, or if they need to just hunker in place and stay there because they're either in the safest place that they might be at that time, or additional time needs to be taken in order to get the information to decide where is the problem, then I think that's in place. But again, I think communicating to the team that we communicating to the congregation, we have a team in place, They will deal with these situations. Protect yourself if need be. If we ask you to stay in place, please do so. If we ask you to evacuate, please go in the direction that we indicate. Because, I mean, people are going to, for the most part, if something chaotic or catastrophic takes place, they're going to go in whatever direction they believe gets them away from that, as opposed to probably what we might be telling them.
That's true. And, you know, as I think about what you're saying and, you know, kind of the situation at hand, you know, it made me think about, you know, what in police world we call, you know, blue on blue shootings. And that's, you know, when you get in, when you engage with a good guy, because you don't know that that person's a good guy. And, you know, a lot of those who are, you know, doing the volunteer church security, I mean, that's one of the things you have to take into account. That's going to be one of the challenges that the congregation is going to need to know, you know, what you look like, because you still will have, you know, visitors or even those who are not part of the security team that may be concealed carriers, and they see, you know, someone, you know, pop up out of, you know, a seat, and they see their firearm, and they see them trying to engage with, you know, because a lot of times your team is going to see it. You know, if they're really paying attention, they're going to see it before the rest of the congregation sees it. And then all of a sudden you have a guy pop up with a gun and maybe even, you know, give verbal commands. And then you have a just a regular visitor or church goer with a concealed carry to engage with him or her. So, you know, you also need to kind of think about how, you know, of course, in New York, they do color of the day. And, you know, how to identify who the good guys are, you know, if it's, you know, something that's known, because the larger you get, you know, just like you said, you guys had a cohesive unit, but every once in a while you have people that you don't work with too often, and you need to be able to identify them. I mean, what would be your suggestion on something like that, how to, you know, help to identify these people?
Well, one of the things we discussed about that, that quite often. Because, you know, not only do you have your integral security team, you also have you're working in conjunction with local PD, and they're doing traffic control and various things. And a lot of times, you know, they've got turnover on their shifts. So we got to know everybody. So but always there was the possibility of someone just being new to the detail, either one of the details, or if something did happen, you're going to have responding law enforcement. And so we talked about, you know, maybe something like a high-vis lanyard or something where you can wear inside your shirt. And then if something started to happen, you could kind of deploy that to try and take your, you know, give your plainclothes guys something to hang on the outside of their clothes in the event of something going down, to identify them to you know, a responding LEO or something like that.
Stan, one of the other things that we did every single time is before service, we had a pre-service meeting with every member of the protective detail in place. So in this particular meeting, we made sure everybody knew who was on the detail. The detail was then given photos, perhaps, pictures, well, not photos of pictures, but the pictures of people that had been seen before that we had concerns about, questionable persons. We had numerous parties at the time that we had concerns about for various reasons. We'd typically get pictures of them. We'd share those pictures. If you see this person, be sure and let the agent in charge or the shift lead know, in case we need to assign a person to, you know, basically for all practical purposes, shadow that person for the duration of the service. So we did that. The other thing is that we then had every single member of the team go and do a sweep of the sanctuary, around the sanctuary, around all the controls in the children's area, walk through there. So basically everybody walked through that area and they looked for anything out of place. Okay. If you found something that was out of place, then, you know, your responsibility was to go ahead and take it to the, or announce it to the AIC, or bring it to the AIC, or in some cases like going, hey, we don't know what this is, but there's a package here. We need somebody to come over here and make a determination on that. And then finally, we get everyone in there, and then we would assign positions. Now, for our particular purposes, rather than assign, let's say, for instance, you were working two different shifts or there are three different services, we would not leave anybody in the same position for all three services. We did a push, so we had like, you know, eight positions. Okay, so we would assign those eight positions, and then between services, you would put to, you would push to the next highest number. So if you had someone in position one, they'd push to position two. If you had someone in position two, they'd push to position three. And so we constantly had that reciprocating, and as a result, we had a lot of familiarity with who was on that team and very little issue with, you know, misidentification.
Yeah, and another thing, just getting back to that sweep, which I think is pretty important. The sweep is the first thing you did. You have a couple of guys doing a complete sweep of the sanctuary. They would look under basically every chair. They would walk down every row, look under every chair. We didn't have pews. We had nice modern theater-type seats. And I always thought that was a good exercise just to kind of get everyone's mind right, that they were, you know, that what they were there and what they were supposed to be doing there. So it was,
yeah, kind of set the table for the mindset of the people working on the team.
No, that's awesome. And, you know, it just kind of, you know, I mean, if you're really going to do it, you have to be serious about it. I love the fact that you guys do sweeps and meetings. I mean, it's so important, you know, to get together and make sure everybody's one mindset. I have two follow-up questions to that, and either one of you can answer it. One is, how do you deal with the challenges of human nature and the fear responses of fight, flight, and freeze? And that's going to happen all over the congregation. That's number one question. And the second question, and this is just, you know, when I think about it, you know, from a tactical perspective, you know, a lot of these members of your church security team, they have families. In my opinion, I think it would be wise, and I don't know what you guys did, but I would have a section further up front designated for the family members of the security team so that they're all in one place and you don't have to worry about it. It would be a secondary thought worrying about your family versus going after the threat. Does that kind of make sense to you?
Oh, that's an interesting issue. It's almost like a surgeon not operating on his own family member because of emotional attachment or something.
Absolutely, that's kind of my position.
Yeah. Well, that we had a lot of guys on the detail that would have family members there. Not everyone, of course, but you know, I don't really know what I think about that, but that's interesting. I mean, you're there to work, you know. I mean, so that's one thing. We were a professional detail, and we worked for a security company that was contracted by the church, and then we were also there when the church transitioned to having it internal. So I looked at it as, you know, these, we weren't volunteers. We were there on a job that we were getting compensated for. And so I certainly understand the thrust of your question as far as, you know, being emotionally clouded at an event like that. But
that's a good idea, especially if you have two officers you can put in the sanctuary at diagonal ends, and you've got one officer that is in very close proximity to where those members are, as you spoke. Then that pretty much frees up the other officer to basically just do whatever job they need to do.
And I think too, Steve, I think that's my point, is that, you know, I mean, when I think about dignitary protection, you know, I mean, it goes along the same lines of, and you haven't spoke about this, and I'll let you speak on, you know, protecting the pastor and those, you know, who are standing up, presenting the word. Those that are important to the church, you know, the hierarchy. And, because a lot of people don't understand that everybody can't run toward the bad guy. I mean, there has to be someone designated to deal with the protection of those, you know, in the hierarchy. And this is kind of why, you know, I want people to, you know, take that into consideration. You know, think about, you know, placing the families of those who are trying to protect you in one area with someone to protect them. Does that make sense?
Makes absolute sense. It makes absolute sense. Some members of the team were assigned to actual people, and some members of the team were actually assigned to areas. And so if I was assigned to a individual person, which I was many times, is wherever that person went, that's where I went. Okay, that person was my responsibility. If I've got somebody over in the children's area, you're not assigned to a specific person in the children's area, but you're assigned to that area. Under no circumstances do you give up that area to go to someplace else. If you can have somebody that is what you guys might refer to as a quick reaction team, or even a single individual that can come and support other individuals, that's awesome. That's the best way to do that. But I think your point is very, very well taken.
Yeah, and then, you know, when I think about church shootings as well, like all of it I just kind of put together, like church shootings, school shootings, you know, I mean, you guys, you know, especially those who can fund these things, you know, I think about how vulnerable all the churches are and schools, and that, you know, there's some great, you know, stuff on the market in reference to, you know, doors, door locks and different things that you can, you know, lock folks in place and, you know, keep people from, you know, coming inside, especially to protect the children. I mean, that's important. You know, also, you know, consider, you know, when people think about, I mean, and they never do, I don't know why, but, you know, fortifying, you know, different things, having roof access points where, you know, not all the time do you, I mean, because there's a difference between a fire drill and a active shooter drill. You know, you're really trying to find places to, because sometimes it's better to, you know, to lock in place or find a hatch that goes up to the roof, per se, you know, so that you're not all running out of, you know, one specific door, you know, because a lot of times, you know, these guys, you know, be it by games or military training, you know, they figure out ways to filter folks into a funnel and sometimes a death funnel and, you know, cause a distraction in one area, have you filter out the next, and then they just mow everyone down. So all of these things need to be taken into consideration when you come up with your plans. And like you said, which I really loved about some people being assigned to people and some people being assigned to areas, you know, really thinking about the dynamics and really the human nature of it. Because I mean, I'm really serious about those who have families there versus those who do not. You know, if you are one that is protecting the children, you know, if you have kids, it'd be nice to, you know, put them over there. But if your family's in the congregation and you're back there protecting the children, that might not be the right guy to put back there, because he's going to be, he's going to be torn. He's going to want to see how his family is and want to go protect them. So you want to put somebody that might be single back there. So these are a lot of things that should be taken into consideration, you know, as part of your plan and how you, you know, you set up your actual, you know, duties and assignments.
And we had secure areas. We had several secure areas, places where we were, in the event of an incident, would take key personnel and get them into an area where they would be secure. And again, it's kind of access control and proper response. And again, the family issue is a real one, especially when you have volunteers, because their family will be at those services, you know, as opposed to as much as our detail, which was, again, you know, we were there on a job.
Well, we had members that had family members there also, yeah. I mean, members of the team. One of the things that you touched on that I thought was just spot on was the ability to secure doors in the event you have like an active shooter alarm. And because a lot of times during the service itself, you have Sunday school, you have various classrooms where children, in some cases adults, junior high or in different rooms, those doors all open out if they're done properly. So then you need an apparatus, and they make them, that will fit over the arms or can otherwise cause that door to be extremely difficult to be opened from the outside. And another thing that I really want to stress is having people positioned near the parking areas and the doorways, especially the main doorways, is very, very important, because somebody that has the intent of causing a really serious active shooter situation has to come through a doorway. And those people can be intercepted there. The team can be identified there. And then again, also kind of taking a step back, is your parking lots are very vulnerable, especially with some of the larger churches or churches that are in perhaps urban areas, where basically you'll see a significant number of burglaries. Those are not unheard of at all. And also robberies. I think I've read some statistics that indicated that most violence that occurred on church grounds actually occurred outside of the church building itself, in the parking lot.
That's true. And, you know, being that you mentioned it, you and I mentioned it, you know, I talked about this before in a earlier podcast, I think around maybe Christmas, when or shortly after one of the school shootings. There's a system out there called the Barracuda Door Defense System, and that's kind of what Steve's talking about. And they have several different ones, you know, that easily you can apply to a door that opens in. They have, you know, the sheath type mechanism that goes over the doors that open out to keep that from happening. You know, so that, you know, a Sunday school teacher, you know, one of this part of this security team can do it and lock everybody in place so that, you know, they are protected. At least, you know, that they can't get into that door. You have to consider changing up if you have doors that have windows in them. You know, that might have to be a consideration, adding, they got the real inexpensive, because I got several cameras in my house, you know that. But they have the inexpensive, you know, camera setups that you can put on the door, on top of the door jamb, and they have alerts on them, you know, so that if you don't have a window, you at least have a monitor in there, or you can monitor by your phone, you know, those who are protecting the kids. I mean, there's just a lot that's out there that's inexpensive that the majority of churches can actually add, and schools, always add that, can add this to, you know, your plan and your setup to prepare for something like this. So yeah. just think about that. It's called the Barracuda Door Defense System on Amazon. You can check that out. And they have a website that you can, you know, find some major thing. We don't get paid by this. We're just telling you what you need to protect your families. I wish I had some stock in it, but I don't. But yeah, so moving on to, you know, because we kind of talked about personnel, we talked about areas of coverage, you know, you talked about training. You mentioned the guys being set up on a diagonal. Tell the layperson why.
Main reason for that is that I can maintain eye contact with that person on a diagonal. Let's say, for instance, position one in our particular church was, okay, that was going to be on the front row, ideally looking to the back. Position two would be on an opposite corner looking forward. So if I'm in position one, I might very well not be able to identify someone initiating some potentially, violent or contemplating some sort of violent action as I'm looking into a sea of faces, whereas the person in position two on the diagonal may very well be able to pick up on that person and move towards that person. So what happens there is I've got eye contact with that other person, which means I can do some sort of communication, nonverbal communication, without necessarily having to use comms. And so the thing that I saw on that is that Alan mentioned earlier, kind of moving perpendicular to the flow of traffic, if I've got something that's happening in the middle and it's in the front of the audience, that allows that one to then move to the middle and then go upstream. It also allows the other person to move to the middle and go downstream if they're closer to the rear. So just having that ability to be in visual contact with everybody in there, see that other person, I've kind of reduced my threat area somewhat by virtue of the very angle. For the most part, I can still see from that position the entire audience, the entire congregation, which the same thing is true for the person in the opposite position.
That's awesome. And then at the same time, you should eliminate any crossfire situations as well, correct?
You do in a large sanctuary, though, the chances of that happening from a correctly trained team member should not be significant, because this is no place to start taking long distance shots. One of the reasons that we encourage all of our officers to wear Kevlar is because we tell them, we need you to move in so close, you're almost at bad breath distance before you engage that person in a crowded congregation, because you've got to control everything. You've got to control the angle. You have to assume you could miss. You have to assume that you could have pass-throughs and everything. Somebody can step in front of you if you're fixated on a threat. You know, I think we've all been there. Like, okay, that guy is my whole world. I don't see anything else. I see that threat. And all of a sudden, somebody can step right between you and that person just about the time you're ready to take a shot, and you've actually fired into someone that you didn't intend to. So
that's right. Yeah.
We're really big on, if it's an active shooter, they're in a congregation, you're going to move almost to contact distance. If you catch that person out, let's say, for instance, atrium area, then you have a little bit more latitude as to how you can engage, with the understanding that a 9mm bullet fired at the horizontal will probably travel 100 yards before it hits the ground. And then even then, it doesn't stop. So you have to be very, very cognizant of what is between you and that shooter, around that shooter, and behind that shooter. But in some instances, what we see now is that if you're in a position where you're not, okay, you've got somewhat of an unimpeded shooting area, you can simply put pressure on those shooters and force them into a barricade position. I'm not wishing this on anybody, but in many of these instances, these shooters have they had no plans of surviving this. And in some cases, they'll either surrender. In many cases, they end up taking their own lives.
That's true. And, you know, sometimes we get in a bad habit on these podcasts too, talking like cops. And when you stated put pressure on the shooter, what does that mean?
That means that I am closing on that shooter. I want that shooter's attention to get away from the crowd. And I want that shooter's attention to be on me. And I want that shooter to understand that I'm coming up there and I'm going to take him out. If he or she does not surrender at that point, I want that pressure on them. We always kind of think of these shooters as being, okay, cool, calm, somewhat detached persons. Emotionally, for the most part, they're under the same pressure anyone else would be. This is a highly stressful event for them. And the very fact that they're having pressure put on them a lot of times can cause them to not perform up to the same level that they think they might be able to otherwise.
No, you're absolutely right. I think back at my times on SWAT and me and Mike's time in Impact and even gangs too. You know, when we do these drug raids, you know, I've done over 700, you've done over 800, 900 drug raids in the past, 20 years. But, it's the same concept, you know, for the layperson, it's why bank robberies work. The element of surprise, mm-hmm. movement and noise. And it's the same thing when you're doing just the opposite. When you think about from a law enforcement perspective or putting pressure on someone, you know, every step that you take, they have to reevaluate their natural fear response as well to fight, flight, or freeze. You know, many times if it's not a dedicated, crazy mofo, mm-hmm. they're going to freeze, especially if, they're engaging and somebody, is pushing you know, bullets back their direction or moving toward gunfire, which is such an unnatural thing that they have to say, well, why isn't this guy turning around and running like everyone else? This might be someone I need to pay attention to. You know, the same thing as, you know, moving off the X. It's the same thing that's taught by a lot of, you know, trainers, you know, a diagonal movement, you know, a circular movement, depending on, you know, what structures are in your path, you know, understanding something as simple as concealment and cover and knowing to get cover, because, you know, that too may be your option, or even a tactical, depending on the situation. And if you're still set up front, a tactical retreat to the same, you know, to get some type of structure so that you can actually deal with the threat. So there's a lot of things that have to be taken into, you know, consideration when you're dealing with a shooter like that.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things I might also add to kind of probably incorrectly quote Mike Darter is that you're not going to rise to the occasion. You're going to default to your training. And so one of the best things that team members can do is actually practice putting this kind of movement, practice this movement on a drill, getting in there close enough to plant your feet and then engage. It's really popular in like IDPA and some other shooting competitions to where shooting on the move is considered to be something that is, you see that actually in several stages that you'll shoot. In reality, shooting on the move while moving through a sanctuary full of people to engage an active shooter is probably not a good idea. I'm a big advocate in that particular instances is I want to move in to that point that I know I've got that shot. And if there's people in there, then I'm going to plant my feet. And I'm going to try to do the very best I can to make that shot surgically with an understanding that anything that I miss or over-penetrates has a distinct possibility of harming or killing someone else.
Well, I'll just say in IDPA's defense, they've gotten away from that. And now you can't be required to move. So, but, you know, we move and we shoot and we can. If we're doing both at the same time, we're probably degrading both of those activities a little bit, you know, suboptimally. So if you need to move, move. If you need to shoot, plant your feet and shoot.
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, and guys who are listening, please understand, it's not going to be a perfect science to this because, you know, you've got groups of humans who are doing who are acting independently of you. So it's more important to me, my opinion, to train as much as you can for difference, you know, and Steve talked about, you know, putting yourself in different scenarios. It's so important to do that than some of your regular target shooting. I mean, of course, you need to do it all. But if you decided to take on the monster of being, you know, volunteer church security, it's really beyond ego. You step into a huge responsibility and you're accountable for hundreds, maybe thousands of people. And you must put in the time and train. You must find some of these, you know, legitimate, experienced trainers, you know, do your research and make sure it's somebody that, you know, is, you know, reputable and, you know, that, you know, they have a great track record. And put in your time, you know, with training firearms, put in your time with real firearms, you know, find yourself a shoot house so you can understand what that's like. Take your team out and, you know, set it up that way, you know, set it up like the church and just kind of go through these things. You know, we used to do a lot of, before our drug raids, you remember we used to do tape houses.
Yeah.
So we would, you know, plot out the structures on the ground with yellow tape, and everybody will understand where the walls are, and we will move through it in practice. I don't think they do that anymore. Mm-mm. But, you know, but it was a great tool, you know, to like move through it and everybody knows where they're going, and you can change the scenario up and put the bad guys in different places and, you know, your stands to shoot in different places. But guys, if you're going to take this on, be serious with it. listen to, you know, the stuff that Steve and Alan are talking about, myself and Mike, and really, you know, develop a real strong team that communicate well and also train your congregation.
Well, and like Alan said earlier, you know, I mean, these are all going to be, you know, whether it's a mass event like this, or it's a, you know, robbery situation, all these are going to be dynamic. They're all going to be different. And it really comes down to not only the training, but also the complex decision making, mm-hmm. you know, under stress, which is very hard to simulate and train. So, and you just have to be, you know, aware of all that you can and take everything into, you know, I mean, it's, that's the complex decision making under stress is what really, you know, tends to get some people in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what the training effect is for. To put yourself under stress, you know, in a training environment, so that it's not, you know, so you stress inoculation, in other words. Mm-hmm. And Stan, something you said earlier, which I couldn't agree with more, or taking things seriously, and things, other things to consider, in a church security situation, or from a church security perspective, the vast majority of the problems you might deal with do not require the use of a firearm. So, you know, I think you need to make sure that, you know, again, you've got, you have no more arrest authority than another civilian, another, you know, if you're just a church security detail, but you probably need to have a broader skill set along the force continuum than just going right to a gun.
That's outstanding, and that's actually something I was going to say, is that if you have a person in the middle of a service starting to create a disruption, that does not in and of itself give you the rights to go over there and put hands on that person, throw them to the floor, and then kick them out of there like it's an old time saloon. Your powers are very, very limited. In many instances, I would probably recommend is that you get up there in a position where if that thing escalates, that you can then do something. If that's the time that you need to call law enforcement and have a uniformed officer respond, if it's a small church, you're probably going to have to call. You know, you're probably going to have to call the local PD or the sheriff's office to get a deputy over there to do that. But it's important not to believe, as Alan said, that you've got some sort of, you know, escalated superpowers in order to deal with these things just because you've been determined to be on the church security team. And you're much more likely to have to deal with a situation like that than you are an active shooter. And finally, or not finally, but the other thing is that after a while, complacency sets in. If you do church security long enough, it becomes boring. And if your church is going to count on you in order to be there during those services, you need to go ahead and realize this is a commitment, because this is not, okay, an opportunity to come out there and go, oh, wow, man, now I can kind of do something that is more exciting, where I might be able to bring my awesome tactical shooting skills to bear. It's very likely not going to happen. But when it does happen, you need to be prepared for it. So that's just one other thing that I really need to kind of throw up and make sure people understand that.
A good shift is a very boring shift.
That's true.
That's true.
Well, guys, we're going on about an hour. So, Steve, thanks for coming back on. Alan, thanks for coming on. It's great to meet you. And this was a great podcast.
It really is. And
it's going to be some good information for a lot of our members.
A lot of questions that we needed, that we're getting every day. So we really appreciate that. Yeah. And, you know, and Steve, his last thought was absolutely the truth. If you think about law enforcement, you know, it's about 1,000 deadly shootings out of 850,000 officers a year. 0.1% of all law enforcement in the nation get involved in deadly force shootings, but they have hundreds of thousands of domestics. And same thing at church. the majority is going to be some type of event that is non-life-threatening that you're going to have to deal with. So once again, you know, like Mike said, use your head, learn how to de-escalate, take our de-escalation training that we have on, you know, CCW Safe Academy. You know, think about avoidance, think about working together, you know, trying to deal with a subject outside of the church. So just kind of escort them out without force. And, you know, lead with sugar and get salty later if you have to. So, you know, that's one of the things I want you guys to remember, okay?
All right. Thanks, guys. Good to talk to you.